I was born on April the 10th, 1893, in Wellsville, New York. And my father's name was Orlando Bergerson, and he was born in 1855. My mother's maiden name was Emma Johnson, and she was born in 1854 in the rural area near Gothenburg, Sweden. My father's occupation was laborer in an oil refinery at Wellsville, New York. The date of their marriage was in 1877 in Sweden. My wife was Hazel B. Riggs, and the date of her birth was June the 19th, 1896, and we were married on July the 7th, 1922. We had one son, Charles Austin Bergerson, and he was born on June the 25th, 1923. I was educated in the Wellsville public schools, and after graduation I attended Syracuse University for 1 year, but suffered a serious illness which kept me out of college for 2 years. And when I returned to college, I went to Hiram College at Hiram, Ohio, where I received a Bachelor of Science degree in 1918, although I left college in 1917 to enter the armed forces. After getting out of the Army on March the 10th in 1919, I came to Albion to become a teacher of the science courses in the Albion. And I served 1 year as science teacher, and the following 5 years I was high school principal and also taught science classes during that period. You want to stop it for a minute?
The Albion schools, I think, is a very interesting history. Back in 1876, the Union Free School District law was passed, and at that time Freeman Green was appointed superintendent of schools and continued until 1900. And at that time Willis G. Carmer became superintendent of schools and continued till 1925. At that time I was appointed superintendent of schools, and I continued from 1925 to February the 1st, 1960. I was succeeded by George Wolfe, who continued for 12 years until 1972. And he was succeeded by Malcolm Hewitt, who was superintendent for 1 year and 3 months when he died of a heart attack. And he was succeeded by the present superintendent, Dr. Howe. I came to the Albion schools in 1929, as I said. I've already given you the history as my science and high school teacher. And I was approved. The curriculum in the schools when I came was very limited because it was largely academic. For instance, in a high school of 300 pupils, we had 3 Latin teachers. Everybody was expected to take the academic curriculum. We had only one vocational course, and it was vocational course in agriculture. That was a single exception so far as vocational courses were concerned. And that was considered to be one of the best in the state because it was the first course in vocational agriculture that was established in Scone. In the early history of the schools, the school board members were elected at the same time as the village officers were elected, and the schools were tied up with the village board and had to submit the budget to the village board for approval. and they decided how much money could be sent in the school budget. And another detriment was the fact that parents could not vote unless they were property owners. And under the Union Free School District law, parents could be allowed to vote. And it was certainly a detriment to the youngsters in the Albion schools that their parents did not have a right to vote unless they were property owners and taxpayers. The first, when I became superintendent, the first change that I attempted to make was to get a new heating plant. We asked for a bond issue, about $25,000 for a new heating plant. We lost it by a resounding majority, largely because parents didn't have the opportunity to vote. So I was concerned about the fact that parents had no particular right to vote and vote for the things that would be best for the pupils who were attending the schools. So I had a conference with members of the State Department of Education, the legal division, told them that I thought it was a clear injustice that under the Union Free School District Act, that schools all over the state under the Union Free School District Act would be allowed to vote so far as school elections were concerned at any time, or if they had a child living with them who was in school age. And I thought it was an injustice, and I thought it ought to be changed. And it was suggested that I send 3 members of the board down to talk with the legal division. And so we sent a committee of 3 people from the Board of Education, went down to Albany, had no audience with Dr. Gilbert, the counsel of the Education Department, and he said that he would be glad to draw up the act if we could get someone from our area to sponsor the act. And so he prepared the legislation, and Dr. Latton, who was our representative from this area in the assembly, agreed to introduce the legislation. And it passed the assembly in 1926. And Commissioner Graves took it to Governor Alfred Smith for his signature. And the governor said, Graves, is this a good measure for the children in the Albion schools? And Dr. Graves started to give a long explanation. He said, I don't want to hear anything more, but is it a good measure for the Albion schools? And Dr. Graves says, well, it certainly is, Governor, and he picked up his pen.
Now, in the following year, after this was introduced,
I asked for an $85,000 bond issue for the heating plant and for other fire escapes on the front of the school and other improvements. And it passed very easily because the parents had an opportunity to vote. In 1928, we began to introduce other subjects and try to get a balanced curriculum so that not every child would have to take a college entrance course unless he wanted to do it. And we introduced business subjects first, and the next year we expanded and introduced additional subjects. In 1931, we purchased a school site on East Avenue and submitted a vote for a new high school and a bond issue of $390,000. This, of course, was during the Depression, and there was some fear that the measure might not pass, but it passed easily because people needed work at that time in this particular area, and I think that was one of the factors that helped us to get it. Well, the building was completed, and we entered the new high school in 1933. And at that time, we were able to introduce shop courses, industrial arts, and home economics, and broaden the curriculum somewhat. And Albion, during these years, had been serving the middle of the county as a high school. And many of the rural schools were open in individual districts, but gradually, out of the 38 districts, 24 of them closed and sent their pupils into the Albion schools, and the other 14 continued to hold their rural schools open. The school population during this period became too great for our building space. And of course we needed new buildings to take care of the pupils. And the question was, could we afford to build a new building in the Union Free School District, which was made necessary because of the increase in rural population that had come into the village schools. And it hardly seemed just that the taxpayers of the Albion Union Free School District should pay for a new building which was made necessary because of the increased school population coming from the rural districts. So the solution seemed to be that we would centralize the schools. And so a committee was set up to study the possibility of centralization of the schools. And this committee was made up of trustees from the rural area and some people from the village. And the results of the study seemed to indicate that we should centralize, and the committee was in favor of centralization. So that report was sent down to the commissioner, and the report was studied. And in May the 6th, 1953, the report came back that a central school district should be established. And it was laid out by the authorities from Albany. So on June 26, 1953, there was a vote for centralization. And 1,199 people cast the vote, and 736 were for it. 443 people were opposed. 19 votes were void, and one blank vote. So in June 30, 1953, there was a meeting of the Centralization Committee, and the Centralization Committee and members of the Board of Education. On July 20th, 1953, was the first meeting of the Board of the Central School District to begin to plan for the operation of the school year. On the following day, June the 21st, 1953, there was a meeting of the Union Free School District Board in order to wind up the business of the old district. It was a busy summer, and on August 6, 1953, there was a budget meeting with Mr. Arnold of the State Education Finance Office, in which we planned the budget for the central school for the year. And then on August the 10th, 1953, we had the first meeting of the Central School Board. And on August 17, 1953, we had the first annual meeting of the Central School District. And we were underway as a Central School District. On December the 14th, 1954, we had a building vote for a primary school. And in addition to the high school, which came as a result of centralization and provide adequate building facilities. And the primary school would take care of a population of practically 700 children. And the addition to the high school with a new cafeteria on the first floor, six additional classrooms, and an additional shop room for machine shop training. At the time, we were voting upon the building proposition. The question came up, should we include a swimming pool? There was considerable doubt that if we did include that the vote for the high school would not, the vote for the building propositions would not go through because of the opposition to the swimming pool. So the board decided to have take an informal vote when we voted on the building. They have one ballot box to vote for the building, another ballot box to ask the voters if they wanted the proposition submitted to the district. And much to our surprise, A majority of the people who voted for the building voted that they did want the proposition submitted for a swimming pool to be included in the building proposition. So we voted on the swimming pool on January the 31st, 1955, and it was approved. So that was submitted along with the building proposition. The building began. In 1955, we sold the bonds for the school building, and on June the 28th, 1955, the bids were opened. And on August 1955, the construction began for the addition of the high school, as I have mentioned, and for a new primary school on the same site. But in acquiring the area, the district for the site required for the primary school, we already had some 20 acres on the site, and we acquired an additional 36 acres, I believe, or approximately 36 acres, for the price of $15,000, which was a very, very small price to be paid for it. So that now, of course, we have an adequate site on which our high school building is built, with our primary school, and with the old high school, which is now the middle school, so we have all of our facilities on one campus, with the exception of the Waterport School, which is part of the district, and where we maintain a separate building. Over a long period of years in the service and school, we have an opportunity to witness the development of the pupils who enter in the primary, who go through 12 years of education in the Albion School and on to college. And this has always been very interesting and very rewarding. Many funny incidents occur during the 40 years of administration in the schools. I can remember one occasion when we were in the old grammar school before the new buildings were built, that the pupils used to assemble in the morning in the auditorium where attendance was taken. And on one morning, when I was high school principal, I came down into the auditorium and the pupils were seated. And we had a statue of Diana, the goddess of chase, down there. And I found that somebody had placed whiskers on her during the morning before, or and so I said to the pupils that it was a decoration that I thought we could get along without. And I said, now I want the pupil who did that to come down as soon as assembly is dismissed and tell me about it. And so the pupil who did it came down and told me that he did it. And I said, well, now you've been honest enough to admit it, and now your job is to take the whiskers off. And then I remember that the students used to, in those early days when I was high school principal, on the last day of school, were usually permitted to take charge and ask the teachers to give little talks, little anecdotes of any kind that might please them. And I remember on one occasion when our agricultural teacher came up front to speak, he started to recite a poem. He said, the last leaf is gone. Then he hesitated for a moment, and he repeated, he says, the last leaf is gone. Then he hesitated a moment, and he said, the last leaf is gone, and so is my speech. I can't remember what I was going to say. And then we always had a few pranksters about. I remember one student who, when he was studying French, didn't do his work. And on one occasion, when he came out and I was in the hall, he came out of a French class and the teacher stood there taking up the written work for the day. And when he came along, the teacher extended his hand, he stopped and shook hands with her and went along without handing in any paper. Of course, he was called to the office and required to do the work.
Mr. Bergeson, would you like to tell me about some of your personal life? Anything that you anything about your child, your family?
Yes, I'd be glad to if you consider it appropriate, but I'd be perfectly willing to have it struck off the tape. I had one son, as I think I said, that was born on June the 25th, 1922. And he attended the schools here and graduated in 1939 as the valedictorian of his class. Came back for postgraduate work because he was only 16 at the time. And then he went to Rochester University. He entered Rochester University in 1940. And he attended classes there for 2 years and until April the 10th of the third year, when he was called into the service. He had enlisted previously, but wasn't called from April the 10th, 1943. But he had already completed in 2 years and 8 months all the requirements for graduation, so he's graduated in 1943, though he would have been in class in 1944, but of course was not present for his own graduation because he was in the service. He was entered in the Air Force as a training for meteorology and took his basic training down at Boca Raton in Florida, and then was sent to the University of Chicago, where he had a master's degree in science and completed the training to the government meteorology course, and was appointed a second lieutenant and was stationed in Bradley Airfield for a time, and then sent to Greenland and was a meteorology officer up there for until he was discharged in 1946. And when he came back in 1946, he entered Columbia University School of International Affairs because he was interested in international affairs, wanted to do what he could do to promote peace in the world. And he also was a graduate of the Russian Institute. He had his master's degree in international affairs and his certificate from the Russian Institute, and he completed all his work for his doctorate except his thesis. And then he was appointed a Rotary Fellow and went to France and studied in the University of Paris for a year. And after he had completed his year, he took 6 months to travel through the countries of Europe who were recovering from the war to see the conditions which had been created by the war. Came back and spent some time at Columbia University and then went to the University of Denver to teach international affairs. And he taught for a short time political science in the College of the City of New York. And then he went to Washington as the chief of the Yugoslav division of the Voice of America. And he was there for 14 years. And then he was transferred to the New York office of the Voice of America, where he was program chairman for Eastern Europe, all the countries of Eastern Europe, and arranged programs for all of those countries. And he continued in that until November the 29th of this year, when he died as a result of surgery. And he had a good career, and I think he did a very good job for the government and carried on under considerable difficulty. And I have received numbers of letters from the State Department and from the officers of the Voice of America, people with whom we've been associated, commending his work and expressing their sympathy because of his, my loss. He, I think, accomplished a great deal for the number of years he lived. He died at the age of 56, but he did have an opportunity to do the kind of work that he wanted to do for his country.
Would you like to tell us, Mr. Bergeson, some of your Rotary activities?
Yes, I became a member of the Rotary Club in August 1922. The club was organized on May the 1st, 1922, and I come in August of that particular year, and I've been a member of Rotary from that time up to the present. I was president of the Rotary Club in 1925, and I've served continuously in the club on one committee or another up through the present time. I was chairman of this student loan fund that we organized in 1933 to loan money to students who needed help to go through college, and I was chairman of that from 1933 up until 1960, as a matter of fact. And during that period of years, when it was very hard for students to get money to go to college, money wasn't as freely found as it is now with the government help, both state and federal. Students found it difficult to get the money to go. And we loaned money to the students, and which they were required to pay back after they left college. And no interest was charged until they had left college, and then the interest was 4%. And through the periods of years, we loaned money to a great many students. And during the period that I was chairman of the fund, I had only one case in which the students did not pay back the money they borrowed, which speaks, I think, a lot for the integrity of the students who were getting it, the money. I think today, perhaps, the big loans by the government, both federal and state, sometimes give students the impression that the money is available for them, and some of them do not assume too much responsibility in paying it back, because it happens to be tax money and owed to the state and the federal government, rather than to an individual or to a Rotary Club. And I think that's probably detrimental to the program, although I know now that the government is making considerable effort to collect the money from those who don't pay back. This, of course, involves only a small percentage of the students, but I think for the sake of their character and their integrity that all students should be required to pay the money back and should be followed up to see that they did pay it back, unless there were some circumstances which made it absolutely impossible for them to pay it back. And so I've continued in the Rotary Club for all of these years, and last year I was made a Paul Harris Fellow, and that comes about by the contribution of the Rotary Club contributing $1,000 to the Paul Harris, to the Rotary Foundation Fund, in honor of the individual. And the Rotary Foundation Fund, of course, is the fund where students are loaned money to take a year of college, undergraduate year, in a foreign country, or to pursue graduate work in a foreign country. And money has been loaned from the Rotary Foundation to a great many students. And the first group, there was only 18 people. My son was in the second group, and there were 25 in that, and now there are hundreds of them who study it under all circumstances. There's a special fund in the Rotary Foundation where teachers who are preparing to teach mentally retarded students are given special education in universities where the work is exceptional in that respect. They also pay for businessmen to spend a couple of months in a foreign country studying the industries in some particular city or village, with a return visit of the people, of business people in that village, to the American city that sent them. And so there is a great deal of good being done to the Rotary Foundation Fund, not only in education, but in many other particulars. They have given money for relief under circumstances and tragedies that have occurred in the various countries. And they continue to want to educate these people, feeling that it is a practical way to emphasize the objective of Rotary, to promote international peace and fellowship among all the peoples of the world. And the Rotary Fellow who does go is required to visit the Rotary Clubs in the area where he is, and to speak whenever they ask him, to tell about the United States and its government. And when he returns, he is committed to visit the Rotary Clubs in his district who want him to speak about his experience in the foreign country and what he's learned. So in that way, our communities learn more about the foreign countries and understand more the problems that they have, as well as the foreign countries which are visited by the Rotary Fellow come to learn far more about America. And it does promote a sense of fellowship and a feeling of a desire for peace throughout all the nations of the world. And I think it's performing a very valuable function. About my own affairs, I have thought about the development of the school district. I hope that the information of the school district will be of interest to people. I'm not sure that my personal affairs are of interest, but since I was questioned on them, I thought it wise to answer the questions, and I hope that I have given anyone who listened to these tape an accurate picture of what the Rotary International accomplishes in the world.
Mr. Bergerson, I would like to know what you could tell me about your association with the Swan Library.
Well, I was associated with the Swan Library for quite a number of years. When Mr. and Mrs. Swan left some $35,000 for the support of the local library, the present building purchased, The bylaws and the Constitution provided for a library board. One of the provisions was that the president of the board should be an ex officio member of the board. Judge Signer, Isaac Signer, was named president of the board and continued in the office until his final illness. When he gave up the office, his son, Charles G. Signer, became president and continued in that office until his death. He was succeeded by Roy McGregor, who continued as long as he was able to do so. And when he resigned, Francis Blake assumed the responsibility for a number of years. When Mr. Carmer was acting as secretary, and he was superintendent of schools here, the librarian was Miss Achilles, who continued in the office for more than a quarter of a century. Miss Achilles was a very precise person and didn't like any salacious literature in the libraries. And if any books came that she thought were not proper to be taken out, she put them aside on a shelf. Mr. Carmer had a key to the library, and he used to come down on occasion on Sunday afternoon and pick out some of the books to read and to pass around to his friends. Miss Achilles was very much upset with this, and so when I succeeded Mr. Carmer as secretary of the library board, she asked me to surrender my key. I did so willingly because I was not interested in any of the books that she had set aside. But Mr. Carmer continued as secretary until 1925, when he retired as superintendent of schools. And on his retirement, I became secretary of the board and continued in that office until Mr. Blake resigned as president, when I was elected as president, I continued in that office, I think, till about 1968. And at that time, Mr. Wolf, who was my successor as superintendent of schools, assumed the office of president. Thus, I served the Swan Library for approximately 43 years. In these early years, and continuing until recently, the library operated on a very restricted budget. The total income in the earlier years was $7,000 to $8,000. We had a small endowment, and the village gave a small amount, and the towns of Albion and Barry and Gaines contributed $100 a year. So thus we operated on a budget of about $7,500. I believe that it was in 1962 or 1963 that the Board of Education began making a contribution of $6,000 to the support of the library. Now they make a larger contribution. The county also makes a substantial appropriation, and other public funds have been made available to the library. It's amazing what fine service was rendered in the early days with such limited finances. Today, because of the added financial resources, needed improvements have been made in the building. More people are available to serve the library and personnel for the library, and the library renders a great service to the community. It has added many functions which the library in its beginning did not have. The addition of the finances have paid off, and the library is rendering a much greater service to the community under the present financial aid received.
Mr. Bergerson, could you tell me about your church membership and your activities in the church?
I became a member of the Presbyterian Church in 1925. So I've been a member of the church for 55 years. I've been more or less active during these 55 years. I had the Young People's Department for a number of years, and I also had a men's class a number of years, and I served on the session for some 25 years. Reverend Erli Hamlin and his family came here in 1925, and he served as the minister for the church for 25 years or more. He was a very active man in the community, and his wife Marjorie was very active in the community also. Reverend Hamlin not only served the church, but he served the community in many capacities. He was interested in the child welfare board, and he was interested in contributions that were made to the neglected and poor people of the community, and was often an agent in securing better conditions for some of those families. Mrs. Hamlin served in the church and worked with the young people. She also taught a class, and she also worked with the Young People's Society over a period of years. And she was active, very active in community affairs. She was particularly active in the missionary affairs of the church. And she was she also organized the Young Women's Service Club, which operates to this day, performs many functions of service, and helps to support students in college by their scholarship program. After Earl Hamlin left, we had a succession of ministers. Reverend Donaldson was our minister for a period of 10 years, and he was followed by Howard Rose, who was our minister for 6 years, and he was followed by our present minister, James Hughes. During the earlier years, I sang in a choir, volunteer choir, for a number of years, and so I've had more or less a very pleasant and active experience in the church over the period of years, and it's been a very pleasant association with a great many people.
Could you tell me, Mr. Bergeson,
in the early years, we had Bert Griswold for quite a number of years, and after Bert Griswold's death, we had Mrs. Helen Woods for a period of years, and after she retired from the work, Mrs. Roy Merrill was organist. And then we had a young couple come into here, Moses Sherman, who was a music instructor, and his wife was an active teacher in the schools from the place from which they came when they came here. And Mose directed the choir, and Margaret Sherman did the music, and they were a wonderful couple. They received a salary, I think it was, of about $800 for the joint services as choir director and organist. But it was all turned back to the church as a part of their pledge during all the years that they were here. And now we have Paul Crowder as organist and also as director of the choir, which requires considerably more financial assistance than was provided to the Shermans. For a long period of time, our choir was directed by Moses Sherman, and his wife was the organist of the church. They received a compensation of $800 a year, but the entire amount was turned back to the church. Mose was a very good choir director. The music was excellent, and the anthems and other music selections at the Christmas program and the Easter program were very unusual indeed. Well, Margaret's father was a Presbyterian minister for a great many years. He was born and brought up in Scotland and worked for a tea company there, and finally became convinced that he should enter the ministry. So he studied for the ministry in the Presbyterian Church. And he came to this continent and was a missionary minister to churches in Nova Scotia, I believe. And he had more than one parish, and he traveled from one parish to the other on snowshoes and spent a considerable period up there. He was there, well, I don't know how many years, but it must have been 25 years or more before he came to the United States. And then he had congregations in northern New York. One of them, I believe, was in Coventry, New York. And he continued as a minister for more than 50 years. And when he retired, he came here to live because their daughter was the only child they had and they wanted to be near her. So he came here and lived. His wife's health was not very good after she came here. And after they'd been here a number of years, she died. He continued to live here in an apartment by himself, even after the Shermans moved north. And he had a hard time trying to decide whether to go where they were or whether to remain here. But he finally decided to remain here, and he was a regular attendant at the Presbyterian Church here. And on occasion, when the minister was gone, he would substitute in the pulpit. He was a very sturdy old gentleman, and he had very definite ideas about religion, and he was very faithful in carrying on his duties as a minister. I used to be with him occasionally, and we would go out to lunch together, and we would have long visits about his experience in the church. I asked him once how he liked retirement, and he said, "I don't call it retirement, I call it expiring." And he was a very fine old gentleman, and I enjoyed friendship with him as long as he lived here. Unfortunately, one morning, they found him on the floor, and he had died of a heart attack, and he was buried here. His daughter has written a book about him. She visited Scotland, talked with his relatives and people who knew him in his early years, and also made a visit to Nova Scotia and got information there, and wrote a book about him, which can be found in the Swan Library. It's a very interesting book and well worth reading.
What is the name of it, Mr. Ferguson?
I can't tell you.
How would a person ask for it?
Find out at the library. Maybe
okay.
We can find out right now. The title of the book that Margaret Sherman wrote about her father is Pastor to the Outpost, and a copy of it can be found in Swan Library.
Thank you, Mr. Ferguson.